You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. Really pleased to have with me once again Alistair MacLeod. He's one of our most frequent and most favorite guests on this show. His weekly articles are posted every Thursday on the Research Insights page at Gold Money. And if you seek a view based on market forces rather than propaganda based on Keynesian economic religion, you really do need to read Alistair's weekly missives. They are very, very important. Can't miss read for me every week, and that's why I'm really happy to welcome him back. Thanks for joining us again, Alistair.
That's very much my pleasure, Jay.
Very good to hear from you, and you do sound a little differently today because you're on a phone, and I was remarking before we started here that it sounds a little bit like the old-time radio audios that we hear these days. But anyway, you sound good. Glad that you could be with us again. We've titled today's show after your April 15th article titled Why the Future Money is Gold and Silver. But actually, before we get into that topic, I would like to have you provide an overview of your April 22nd article titled Why Interest Rate Management Fails, because I think it explains why central banks are digging our monetary system into a deeper and deeper hole that ultimately guarantees the collapse of our monetary system. That really sets the stage for a return to gold, as you're suggesting in your April 15th article. Since the financial crisis of 2008, a huge amount of money has been pumped into the financial system, but it isn't getting lent out into the economy as it was previously. And I noticed a chart the other day, and this was separate from your article. There are four of the top banks in the United States have piled up $2.5 trillion more in deposits than in loans. It seems a lot like the pushing on the string analogy that some made of the 1930s Great Depression. Can you explain why banks are not lending out all that money that's sitting in the system?
Yes, certainly. The reason they're not lending it out actually is quite simple. Their balance sheets are very highly geared. They haven't actually got much space on the balance sheets.
Uh-huh.
So they're reluctant to lend more money into the non-financial private sector. Instead, what they would rather do is play the bull markets in, obviously we've got government bonds, which when it comes to zero interest rates, because banks really walk out beyond a five-year maturity, they feel quite comfortable in that space. And on top of that, of course, there's agency debt, and then there's other financial things going on, and you've got a bull market in equities. So that's really where they have moved their balance sheet concentration. And if you look at just the big banks, as reported by on the H8 Fed's form, you can see that roughly 61% of their balance sheet is aimed at non-financial lending, and the rest is financial lending. Now, this has changed from a longer-term relationship of over 70% of the bank's balance sheet going into non-financial lending. So you can see how they've reduced their position. There is a difference between the big banks and the smaller banks. The smaller banks, who tend to know their customers a lot better than the big banks, they have maintained a roughly 70% exposure to the non-financial sector. But you can see that, apart from the attractions of dealing in financial things, in the wake of all the COVID shutdowns, and you've got some very substantial problems in things like shopping malls, you've got problems in the aircraft industry, the hospitality industry, and so on and so forth. You've also got supply chain disruption. Mm-hmm. So you can see that there is every reason why the banking sector has gone really very, very cautious on increasing their exposure to the non-financial part of the economy. And, of course, this has huge impacts on the situation once we come out of lockdowns, because obviously, you know, we hear about people's cash balances have risen. They're going out, they're buying property, they're even buying super yachts, for goodness sake. I mean, anything that you can gear up on, you know, the middle classes have been doing that. And it's not just in America, it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. And consequently, once the lockdowns end, you can see that there is going to be a brief tsunami of money, if you like, going out of these accounts into the economy, and there isn't the product there to satisfy it. And this is why we're beginning to see enormous inflationary pressures build up.
Yeah, we are seeing it, and we're going to hear from our Fed chairman tomorrow, and somebody said he's going to say, don't believe your lying eyes. I guess, you know, we're not supposed to believe there's any inflation problem, right? I mean, there never is any inflation problem, Alistair. You know that.
Well, we know that because the statistics have been adjusted so that we don't notice it. But it is going to be interesting to see what the Fed says tomorrow, because so far what they've done is they said, yes, we can see that prices will rise a bit faster than our 2% target, but we're going to go for an average of 2% over time, and therefore we think that this is a phenomenon that will go away, and we will return back towards our 2% target. So nothing to worry about. But one wonders. I mean, these pressures are certainly there. They're greater, I think, than the Fed thought they were perhaps a few months ago. And it'll be interesting to see whether they modify their stance just a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, people here are being paid not to work, essentially. The restaurants are having a hard time finding people to go back to work because they're finding, you know, the lower paid jobs are getting more from the government and so forth. So there's a lot of reasons. And you're saying supply chain disruptions and so forth. So if I hear what you're saying, with all this money in the system, people really chafing at the bit to spend it and to buy things and probably to buy tangibles, are you really concerned then that we have an inflationary problem that might get out of hand? And if that happens, then what happens to the bond markets?
Yes, precisely. And I mean, inflation is there. Inflation is money. In the last year, M2, and they've modified M2 to make it look slightly less alarming, but M2 has gone up, I think, something like 22% over the last 12 months or so. Now, this is, you know, the effect on prices is enormous. And, of course, immediately they started doing QE at $120 billion a month, which was March 2020. At that point, commodity prices just took off, and they haven't stopped rising. I mean, you just look at things like lumber and also some of the food, you know, the foodstuffs like soybeans and maize and so on. I mean, you know, they've just gone through the roof. You know, this is going to hit ordinary people. I mean, ordinary people who can't get jobs, ordinary people who are living, if you like, you know, in the hope of, you know, sort of being bailed out by the government. This is actually very, very serious for the ordinary person in America. And do remember that before all this happened, the statistics, both in the U.S. and the U.K., said that salaried people, roughly 70% of them, lived paycheck to paycheck.
Uh-huh.
What's happened to them? This is serious. And I another point I'd like to make, Jay, is that we hear an awful lot about economic recovery and so on and so mm-hmm. forth. Now, this is predicated on perhaps the middle classes, the professional classes, who have managed to continue to get an income through the pandemics. We're talking about lawyers, doctors, accountants, and so on and so forth, stockbrokers even. Consequently, they've got money to spend. These are the people targeted by the mainstream media. The mainstream media says everything looks jolly nice. But actually, if you look at the wider economy, the wider consumer situation, it is not nearly as rosy as being made out.
Absolutely, which means then even more government money, central bank created money out of nothing, pumped into the system. I suppose helicopter money is what is needed for those people. I mean, they're not going to get bank loans or even credit card loans. They need Uncle Joe to send them some money.
I think that's right, and I think it'll happen. I mean, the idea that we're going to get a wonderful economic recovery and that's going to sort out the government deficit, I mean, to me, that's just cloud cuckoo land. It really is. That's not going to happen.
So, Alistair, you made some comparisons in your most recent article, the one about interest rates, to the 1930s in some ways. That was a deflationary period of time, and the dollar gained strength. I think you're not looking at it in that way. I think you're looking at it in terms of getting money into the economy through the banking system. Maybe there's some similarities there, but you're certainly not looking then for any kind of a deflationary outcome and a stronger dollar, are you?
No, the big difference between 1929-32 and the current era is that in 1929-32, prices reflected the fact that the dollar was fixed at $20.67 to the ounce of gold. So prices, mm-hmm. in effect, were more or less in gold, if you like, through the dollar. Yep. Today, of course, we've got a completely fiat currency. And consequently, the purchasing power of the currency is taking the strain. And it is falling at quite a substantial rate in terms of the things that you would buy with it. Now, this is yet to work through in its most dramatic form to final goods. But you can already see in terms of commodity prices, just as I mentioned just now, how weak not only the dollar but other currencies are measured against those commodities. And it's not for nothing that we've seen the cryptocurrencies go absolutely wild in this money printing environment. And silver has gone up substantially, gold less so. But that gold is the aberration in this situation. And I would expect that is, if you like, it's very much the clearest signal that the markets are broken, the markets are mm-hmm. distorted. And when you get that, the return to proper market pricing can be very sudden. And that return, I think, is likely to catch a lot of people out, people who may be committed to cryptocurrencies, to equities, to bonds, fixed interest bonds, and all that could change very rapidly overnight. So the point is that markets are really broken, and this is quite a dangerous situation for people trying to protect their capital.
Yeah, well, markets may be broken. You see it, and people that look closely, especially through the eyes of Austrian economics, see the market is broken. But the vast majority of people don't see that. They don't see it. What will it take for people to see it, for it to be broadly recognized that the markets are broken, and cause them to look for something different than Uncle Joe and more dollars?
I think the key thing to look out for is the next rise in term yields on fixed interest bonds. Uh-huh. We've had one rise so far. I mean, if you look at the 10-year U.S. Treasury, the yield on that has risen from a low of about 0.54%. It's currently around about 1.6%, 1.7%. Uh-huh. It's consolidating at this level. The next move up through 2%, I think, will probably begin to undermine equity markets and change things around. So that, to my mind, is the key to the whole thing. And remember, we've had this conversation before, Jay, that mm-hmm. this is just so much like the situation in France in 1720 when John Law basically puffed up the one stock, which was the Mississippi Venture, to pay taxes on the one hand and also to equip a fleet because he had a monopoly on France's imports and exports. And that collapsed, and the currency collapsed with it. And what are we doing today? We're doing exactly the same experiment, except it's on a global scale, and it is far, far larger. So collapse of markets, and they are very overvalued. I mean, more so, perhaps, than at the time of the dot-com bubble. So that situation, when I talk about markets being broken, I mean, and markets then repricing properly, that is going to be a major, major impact. So look out for interest rates. That would be my advice.
Yeah, interest rates start to rise, and it breaks things. So obviously, we can't take much more than 2% or so before, and not to mention the government's and what that means for the government borrowing and so forth, and who's going to buy. So they're going to the Fed will presumably try to suppress the rates and not allow them to go where the market would require them to fund the deficit. And so that means more and more, faster and faster money is going to have to be printed and created by the Fed in order to try to hold things together. At some point, you would think the dollar would give way. You would think that fiat currencies generally would start to lose confidence when they start to recognize that they're, you know, what's going on, right? And is that when the system breaks down and people are going to need to look for, when the confidence is lost in the dollar, in the system, that's when they might start to look for alternatives?
Yes, I think the confidence goes in financial markets first, and then the dollar, if you like, gets hit as a consequence. The interesting thing, though, is back in 1720, Richard Cantillon, who is a very shrewd banker, and we know him in another context, he played the failure of the John Law thing, basically not by shorting the stock, but by shorting the currency, which he did in the London and Amsterdam exchanges. And he was absolutely right, because there was some residual value in the stock, but the point was that the French livre went to zero. So he did extremely well, and that was his second fortune. And I think that's probably a pretty good steer as to how we should look at things now.
Okay, well, just a few minutes, not enough time left, Alistair. Well, let's get to your article about why gold is the inevitable place to go, why the markets are going to demand it, even if governments kick and scream against it. In your April 15th article, you say that those who think crypto is the money of the future are, and I quote you, naive, exposing hardly any knowledge of what qualities are needed for sound money. So can you talk about the attributes required to make money sound, and why, when given a choice, you are confident that the public will choose gold and or possibly silver to an extent, but not Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies? Talk about the attributes that make for sound for sound money.
Okay, well, the first thing is that it must be beyond the control of governments, and it must be in the control of the people. The people decide how much money they need in their basic economies. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that the sound money of the future must be flexible. And in the case of gold, the way to look at it is that roughly 60% of it is in jewelry. Some of that jewelry is very close to being monetary gold, but the balance, which is around about 80,000 tons, of which 35,000 tons is in the hands of the central banks, you could call monetary gold. Now, the point is that if demand for gold increases, then there is a supply, and it comes in via mines and also through scrap. So you do have the flexibility. You can run a bond market in gold-backed currencies, and most importantly, when you get a collapse of paper currencies, the only asset, non-fiat asset, that central banks have is physical bullion. So they will mobilize that to stabilize their currencies. Now, I mean, in the past, we've seen this happen fairly late in the game. You could easily see a situation where the collapse of the dollar is such that the price in terms of a ounce of gold will be over $100,000 an ounce. And now, bear in mind, that's not gold going up; that's dollar going down.
Exactly.
That is the key to understanding this situation. But this contrasts with Bitcoin, for example, which people tout as the money of the future, because that's got no flexibility at all. If you were to have a bond market in Bitcoin, then I would guess you would have to have heavily negative interest rates, simply because over time, production is likely to expand. It always has done in the past, yet, whereas there is a cap on Bitcoin at 22 uh-huh. million Bitcoin, and that is it.
Mm-hmm. Of course, there are other currencies, too. Yeah, there's other cryptocurrencies, too, but clearly they all, they don't have the acceptability, the public acceptability over thousands of years that gold and silver have. So,
Absolutely. And think about most of the users. I mean, they're not tech-savvy people. All right, they've got mobile phones and all the rest of it. But they're not tech-savvy people. You know, they actually like to sort of, know that they've got gold coins, or if they've got paper money, that they can exchange it for gold coins. And you're not going to change that just through technology.
As you point out in your article, the reason you buy gold is not to get rich. You buy it to preserve wealth. You buy it because you're fearful, or you believe there's a chance that the currencies are going to lose value. And so it's sort of an insurance policy. And I guess if you want to invest, you might buy gold shares, or you might buy some other things that make some sense. But you're quite convinced that we're not that far away, I believe, from a real problem with the confidence in fiat currencies globally.
Yes, that's right. And as we said earlier, when you get a rise in interest rates, and I think you made the point, which is absolutely correct, government finances start sliding down the slippery slope very, very quickly. And the only way in which they can balance their books basically will be to print money, because we've got an economy which is not robust. There is the hope there will be some consumer spending, but that's going to drive up prices for the reasons we've just discussed, and interest rates will therefore rise. And when interest rates rise, government finances will be irretrievably bust, and visibly so. And at that stage, how do you value a government? Well, you look at its currency and say, well, its currency perhaps is far too high, and we ought to sell it. And that's and it's not just the dollar; it's every other currency. And the problem is that every other currency is also tied to the dollar.
Yeah, with just a couple of minutes left here yet, Russia and China have been building their gold reserves. Historically, it has always been the case that when countries start accumulating gold, it's a sign of their wealth and their prosperity and their growth, their ascension, if you will, towards greater wealth. Whereas when countries see their gold leaving their shores, it's usually a sign of the opposite, that things are not as good as they once were. What do you make of this massive rise in gold holdings by China and Russia to a lesser extent, probably a lot greater than the Chinese are admitting to, right?
Yes, in my view, and I can't substantiate this, but there is a lot of circumstantial evidence that supports my view. The Chinese have probably got about 20,000 tons, maybe even 25,000 tons of gold, which is not declared as monetary gold. Now, this is important because I think that the intelligence services in America realize this. The last thing they will want to see is gold coming back as money, because it would immediately empower China in particular, but also Russia, because Russia is a major producer and presumably has done the same thing in terms of keeping some gold off the books, as it were. And so gold would favor Asia against America. Now, America is meant to have 8,132 tons, but of course that hasn't been properly audited for some considerable time. We don't actually know what the central banks really have, but the one thing that we can be fairly certain of, and that is that while Western central banks have leased their gold, perhaps it hasn't been returned, we don't know that situation, but as far as China and Russia are concerned, they are likely to have considerably more gold than they let on.
Right, and indeed Russia has decided it's going to try to use the dollar as little as infrequently as possible. So, Alistair, I think, go ahead real quickly.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, the various attacks on Russia in the past, financial attacks, have convinced Russia that it needs to be separate from the SWIFT banking settlement system. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it needs to get away from the dollar so that it can't be attacked by the withholding of payments by America to, you know, as a means of attacking Russia.
Right, exactly. Alistair, I want to thank you very much again for being with us. Your insights are always very, very valuable, and we thank you very kindly for being with us and look to have you back again sometime soon. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Jay.
All right, folks, that is it for this week. Next week, Peter Buchbar will be with me for the first time. He's with the Blakely Advisory Group, and Chris Taylor of the Great Bear Resources Company will join me. Until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.